You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 19th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Anthony LaPay on America's War on Drugs. It's a new series on the History Channel, laying bare the secret realities of America's war on drugs, from the CIA's connection to mafiosos who smuggled heroin, helped try to assassinate Castro, through the heroin trafficking that defines the war in Afghanistan, the CIA's role in all of it, that and so much more. It's an unbelievable series. And Nomiki Konst of the Young Turks, talking about the Unity Reform Commission and what's next for progressive politics and the Democratic Party, just days away from the Georgia special election. Yes, Senate Republicans might change the House Republicans' horrific, grotesque health care bill. They might cut Medicaid even more. That's right. Even as that process remains entirely opaque, completely secretive, an assault on Enlightenment values, according to Brian Beutler. Donald Trump tweets away. Apparently he's under investigation. His lawyers are stressed. No one knows what's going on. There is a there. But we can't possibly keep up with the fire hydrant of all of it. There's something going on there, folks. Senate, nearly unanimously, only with two dissents, passes a new package of sanctions against Iran. Even as that deal is working, the Qataris say, hey, none of our people were involved in 9/11. Just to be clear, as the Gulf crisis continues on unresolved, public fire at the Tower in London as austerity kills. Theresa May is chased out of a public meeting, and Jeremy Corbyn presents the most brilliant solution imaginable to addressing the homelessness caused by that crisis. This death toll reaches 79 people. Really, really horrific process. Emmanuel Macron's party wins big parliamentary gains, but in very low turnout. That and so much more on today's Majority Report. We're, of course, back live. The Senate is moving, and, you know, there's some wavering, apparently, by, I will never use the phrase Republican moderates, but there's wavering, apparently, by a couple of people on the right, far right, and a couple of people on the far, 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 far right. Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins need to know how to cover for themselves and pretend that they don't support devastating cuts in Medicaid and Planned Parenthood.
Or they just need to be seen trying to care.
They need to be seen trying to care. Everybody needs to be seen trying to care about pre-existing conditions. And Ted Cruz and Mike Lee would like to overtly make it even worse than it already is, even as Mitch McConnell quietly moves the thing to devastating effect. And you're thinking about, you know, this is a piece of legislation that is going to affect millions of people. It's going to degrade healthcare for Americans across the board, starting with over 20 million people that will lose it. It's a vicious assault on the middle class, working class, anybody that isn't extremely wealthy. And of course, the whole point of doing it is to just give a tax giveaway to the extremely wealthy. But we've already talked about and noted that, you know, it's a group of white men dictating a policy that will disproportionately affect poor people, women of color, children, and people of color generally. and anybody, by the way, it's also a room full of rich people, creating policy that will affect anybody that has to work for a living. It's also a group of senators that represent maybe a third of the country at most, small rural states, creating policy in a completely undemocratic and representative manner that will hit people in major coastal hubs where there is no representation of senators from places like California or New York. So next time you hear a coastal elite rap, think about that. How about the Utah elite that's about to destroy California's health system? And it's, again, entirely opaque. And this is Bernie Sanders. People have criticized Bernie Sanders. Again, I have to say, seems to be pretty baselessly. Yes, he is criticizing the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party needs to urgently do better. This is a matter of almost national security that the Democratic Party become competent. But he has been relentlessly talking about what the Republicans are doing to health care. And here he is on Face the Nation with John Dickerson on Sunday, describing the level of secrecy that Republicans are applying to the health care bill.
To health care, you mentioned some of the policy differences, but there is a procedural debate going on about how this is being handled in the Senate. Some Democrats are suggesting because you don't know what's in the bill and the bill is being worked on in secret, to just stop all Senate business, to just shut the place down as a way to kind of force play. Are you on board with that?
John, here is the situation. We know the legislation that passed the House. It was the worst piece of legislation, frankly, against working class people that I can remember in my political life in the Congress. Throwing 23 million people off of health insurance is beyond belief. Now, in the Senate, what you have is you have, I believe it is 10 Republicans working behind closed doors to address 1/6 of the American economy. That's what health care is. Republicans, the average Republican doesn't even know what's in that legislation. My understanding is that it will be brought forth just immediately before we have to vote on it. This is completely unacceptable. I mean, nobody can defend a process which will impact tens of millions of Americans, and nobody even knows what's in the legislation. And, John, the important point here is the reason they don't want to bring it public is because it is a disastrous bill, I suspect, similar to what passed in the House. Who is going to defend cutting Medicaid by $800 billion at the same time as you give massive tax breaks to the wealthiest 2%? So they want to keep it secret. They don't want the media involved. They don't want members of Congress involved. And at the last minute, they present it, they push it through, and that is 1/6 of the American economy and millions of people thrown off the health insurance. That is unacceptable. I believe Democrats should do everything they can to oppose that legislation in any way that we can.
Very important point at the end. Yes, Democrats need to go nuclear on this. This is the most important issue ethically, policy-wise, and from an electoral standpoint. This is the preeminent one right now. We're not even defending a robust national health care system. We're defending the significant and real gains that Obamacare did create. We have a dangerous shock doctrine predator party whose sole purpose is to destroy the well-being of Americans in a ruthless, endless quest for upward financial redistribution. That's it. And it's a clear and present danger to the well-being of almost all Americans. If you live in particularly Maine, Alaska, or Ohio, call Portman, Collins, Murkowski, and say you're watching them and you know that they need and you appreciate their support for Medicaid, you appreciate their support for Planned Parenthood, and their moderate positions. You know, if you're in Texas or Utah, say you need to hold it up because it's not crazy and insane enough, Mike Lee or Ted Cruz. But really, call everywhere. If you have any Democrats, say this needs to be the preeminent piece of business that you're dealing with now, period. This is a major, major threat to the well-being of tens of millions of Americans, and it needs to be dealt with as such. With everything going on in the world, it can be hard to keep up with all the latest political moves and perspectives. It certainly can be. It's absolutely exhausting. And if you take a couple of days like we just took I mean, it just gets overwhelming. It cuts up. And that's why I love Texture. It's an app that lets me read trusted sources. I told you I read, you know, Rolling Stone, Matai Ebe. Sometimes, you know, Newsweek has great investigative reporting, actually, that I keep up with. All sorts of sources, and I can curate it and follow specifically what I need. Authors, topics, subject areas, all the rest of it from the convenience of my phone, my iPhone. It has 200-plus magazines available. Texture puts an endless supply of in-depth and interviews into the palm of your hand. And as I say, I mean, I just, there's, it's an essential tool for me to manage the insanity of the news cycle and follow subject areas I want, follow authors I want, and also get, you know, keep up with Fast Company. You know, I actually read Variety too sometimes. Check out other things. I started reading Variety because Sam kept talking about it. And thanks to Texture's daily recommendations and inclusive interactive feature and exclusive interactive features, you can easily pinpoint the articles that you want to read. Plus, Texture is searchable, so you can mark what you like, check out old issues, view bonus video content seamlessly. Everything from National Geographic to Fast Company to Rolling Stone is available for way less than the Texture app, which is selected as one of Apple's top 2016 iPad apps. Texture is normally $9.99 a month, but if you sign up right now at texture.com/majority, you get 14 days for free. It's a 14-day free trial. That's 14 days to try Texture for free when you go to texture.com/majority. That's texture.com/majority. And springtime is a great time to reset, hit the reset button, and retackle personal goals like getting fit, cleaning, and cooking. Luckily, Blue Apron makes an incredible home cooking easy and accessible for delivery. For delivering seasonal recipes with step-by-step instructions and pre-proportioned ingredients right to your door, all for less than $10 a meal. You can even customize your recipes based on your preferences and select a delivery option that's right for you. Plus, there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Here are some of the meals available in June. Warm smoked trout asparagus salad with fingerling potatoes and garlic croutons, spiced zucchini enchiladas with creamy lime and tomato rice, Alat style vegetable tostadas with summer squash, poblano peppers, and cilantro rice. Wow. Peach honey glazed chicken with mashed sweet potatoes, collard greens, and Thai basil. I love Blue Apron, and I can't wait to try all of them, actually. And it's incredibly easy to prepare and efficient. And there's also it's easier to clean up after as well, which is important for some people. I know particularly Matt does not like the cleaning time. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You'll love how the food feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority, blueapron.com/majority, Blue Apron, a better way to cook. We'll be right back with Anthony LaPay on the Majority Report.
Rock me nice and easy. Rock me nice and slow. In the early morning, you turn me on. So let the good times roll. I said them try fi separate with, but me no wanna crack fi smoke. Give me the ital in my brain and let it light up in my dome. I wonder if I'm me alone one. Steam in the sense every time. I wonder if I'm me alone one. Burning every time. I said fi give me the highest grade. Perfect tree. I love my marijuana. Rastaman, strictly herbs for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. I say me granny say no touch it, and he say grandma you're insane. Nobody incriminate. Coaching.
never hurt nobody's brain. It is the healing of the nation. Mama, what you talking about? I said it good for your meditation. And she said, boy, just shut your mouth.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Sorry about that technical hiccup, everybody. That'll be fixed on the show later. Joining us now is Anthony LaPay. He's the showrunner for the new History Channel series, America's War on Drugs. It's unbelievable. Fine work, my friend. How are you doing?
Good, good. Good to be here. Thanks.
You know, Anthony, I think that if you ask your, maybe not your average person, but probably someone that listens to this show as an example or watches this show, they would probably have some recognition of like, oh yeah, the CIA, at the very least, they were, you know, they let people in Latin America that we were working with in the '80s, they looked the other way while they smuggled cocaine to fund their covert wars. They might have a sense of that. Maybe if you stretch a little bit more, some people might know now that the former president of Afghanistan's brother was a heroin kingpin, Hamid Karzai's brother. They might know that. But they might not know that the origins, that the whole parallel history of America's modern relationship with drugs, from LSD to heroin, has always had a relationship with the intelligence services and with U.S. foreign policy. In some ways, it's almost like a way that you can understand the modern world through how drug markets are working. Take us back to a guy named Traficante, Floridian gangster, Cuba, heroin, and the CIA in the beginning of this. It's a crazy documentary, four-part series. It premiered last night. It's on again tonight and for the next couple of days.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was very similar to the sort of knowledge base that you described when I came into this project. I had always had a sort of cursory knowledge and understanding that there had been these sort of crossovers and the sort of turning a blind eye to this stuff. But when we started digging into it, it really is a mind-blowing story that if you look at all the major hotspots for drugs around the world, there is a complete overlap to U.S. foreign policy, mostly all during the Cold War and then later in the War on Terror in Afghanistan. And not only is there this overlap, but there's a direct correlation between the rise of these different drug lords in their relationships and their protection by the Central Intelligence Agency. It's one of these stories that I think a lot of people considered, you know, quote unquote conspiracy, but it's one of these things when you dig into it and when you watch our four-part, eight-hour series on this, I think it's hard to walk away not seeing that it is the secret history of the last 50 years. So where we start is with a gangster named Santo Traficante Jr., who is a Sicilian mobster who was happily running his operations in Havana up until a guy named Fidel Castro came in, took over, kicked him and the mob out. And I think there's like a big myth, a lot of people when they watch The Godfather and these other movies, that the mob, you know, wasn't into drugs, right?
Right.
The mob was knee-deep in drugs,
right.
And the whole French Connection heroin trade had this whole stop in Havana, and heroin was pretty much controlled by the mob, and a big part of it was coming through Havana. So when Castro takes over, the CIA now all of a sudden has a mutual interest with the mob to get rid of Castro, and the CIA goes in, and they actually hire Santo Traficante to help coordinate an assassination plan to poison Castro that was going to coincide with the Bay of Pigs invasion. The Bay of Pigs invasion also, as your viewers may know, you know, involved a huge paramilitary operation where the CIA was training all these ex-Cubans to go in and invade and take over. Of course, as history, as people know, the Bay of Pigs was a gigantic debacle. The poison plot fails. The Bay of Pigs fails. And then all of a sudden, you have all of these out-of-work Cuban exiles, anti-Castro guys who have been trained by the CIA in paramilitary operations that then decamp to South Florida, where a guy named known as the Blonde Ghost who's the head of the CIA's Miami station there, begins training them in paramilitary operations to keep fighting Castro. But these guys are all out of work. So essentially, they go into the drug trade, and they basically have get-out-of-jail-free cards from the CIA. And this is really the beginning of South Florida drug trade. And by the end of the 70s, it's estimated that a huge portion of both the cocaine and the heroin trade are controlled by these guys. It's a crazy story, and it's actually a story that we were turned on to by this guy named Evan Wright, who's an amazing writer. He's one of the writers on Homeland, and he wrote a book called American Desperado. He has a new book out that everyone should check out called How to Get Away with Murder in America, about a CIA hitman who the CIA hitman guy really told him this whole story. What's really insane is the core guys from the Bay of Pigs operations you see pop up throughout the next 30 years. They're in Southeast Asia and Laos, Felix Rodriguez and these other guys. They're in Central America running the, training death squads in El Salvador. At the same time, they're helping the Contras run coke. There are these crazy zealot characters. They're involved in Watergate.
Right.
So it's a crazy story.
Yeah. We're gonna loop back to this, because by the time you get to the 80s, this sort of fusion in Latin America of the CIA, Cold War extremism, far right politics, and cocaine revenue streams is like the defining policy framework for particularly the Reagan administration, but all kind of administrations moving through from the late 50s to the 80s. Then you have this other totally bizarre and one of the things that I like about it that's really good about the documentary is that, so I guess it's not like, okay, the CIA did this intentionally to get coke in certain communities or fuel crack in certain communities. It's more just that we have a geostrategic objective, or we have our own, sense of what we want to do in Laos or Afghanistan or wherever, and we're going to work with whoever and do whatever to accomplish that, period. Whether that involves, smuggling heroin or cocaine, or whether that involves, being complicit in death squads or orchestrating death squads ourselves, right? And the other thing that happens... go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's really about these secret wars, right? So we had a secret war in Laos where officially... we weren't supposed to be there. We weren't supposed to have troops on the ground. Congress, was kept in the dark. We had an agreement with the Soviets that we weren't going to put troops in Laos. But there basically was a whole other communist insurgency happening in Laos. At the same time, our whole war against North Vietnam and the Viet Cong were happening next door. So it had to be done through a proxy army, just like at the Contras in Nicaragua. It had to be done in secret, and it had to somewhat fund itself, because there's only so much of a black budget you can pull to fight a gigantic war.
Right.
So that's where drugs come in, and it actually makes perfect sense. I mean, Evan Wright says it. If you look at how the CIA operates, and if you look at how drug traffickers operate, there's huge similarities. They have to work in the dark. They need secret bank accounts. They need logistics. They need to move things. They need dangerous people willing to do dangerous things. So there's a huge commonality in the modes of operation between drug traffickers. And it's also, when you're fighting these secret wars, it's often the guys who are the drug traffickers who are the baddest guys in town that we're going to fight against communist populist uprisings.
Right, totally. So then the other, and we're going to get to more of that in Bolivia, Colombia, Afghanistan, but then there's kind of these other parallel threads at home. How did the CIA help create the psychedelic movement?
This is, again, one of these stories that I had heard a little bit about, I knew a little bit about. I think people maybe have come across the program called MK Ultra, which was a secret drug testing program by the CIA to try to at first create a sort of super soldier with acid, and then try to use it as a truth. When that didn't work, try to use it as truth serum. But what I did not realize,
certain kind of truth,
Right, exactly. What is mind-blowing is, what I never understood is, it actually, this wasn't something that happened later in the 60s, which though it went on for a long time, it actually happened in the early 60s, and it actually happened on a major scale, where in the 1950s, the U.S. had heard that the Soviets were looking to get a hold of LSD. They went over to Sandoz Laboratories, where LSD had been originated in Switzerland, and bought the world's supply of acid, brought it back to the United States, and launched these at first programs using test subjects in universities. And Ken Kesey in 60 or 61, while a student at Stanford, is dosed by a secret CIA program through Stanford, through the Veterans Hospital there, while he's at Stanford. He loves it so much, he gets a job as a nurse in the Veterans Hospital, and basically steals the whole stash and essentially starts the whole acid movement in San Francisco. So it's in, at the same time, you have guys like George White, who is a federal narcotics officer secretly working for the CIA. He's doing his own tests, which included him basically creating a safe house with a two-way mirror where you get prostitutes to take guys back, unwitting, just civilians, random dudes, dose them, and he'd sit there and just kind of geek out watching them have sex and taking notes. And it was really his own bizarre fantasies. And the weird outlier characters involved in these programs will blow your mind.
Yeah. It's like beneath that buttoned up facade of like G-men and kind of like, you know, the image that these intelligence services, they want you to have like an image of, you know, like Argo or something like that.
Right.
And the reality is, I mean, you know, and I don't want to, I mean, these are complex organizations like any other, but just the amount of, you have to be a pretty bizarre person to be down to do stuff like this. So, you know, it's just the kind of same principle you're talking about before with like, who in town is going to be willing to help organize a death squad for you and have the artillery and the money to do it? Well, who's going to want to, you know, I mean, you're just kind of basically talking about people that were just like the evil versions of like Timothy Leary or Ram Dass, you know, like, hey, man, you know what I mean? But it's also weird because the other thing that I think that comes out of the LSD story is in a way like, this one specifically was that it backfired. All of these stories backfire and have blowback, but the weird blowback,
ways.
Yeah,
and just absolutely massive. The unintended consequences of all these CIA operations. I mean, it's almost comical when you look at, you know, how, you know, you have these major operations in Laos to help this warlord who basically is somewhat of an obscure general when we come in, and then basically 3 years later he's the largest heroin trafficker in the world,
right.
And you know, a huge percentage of our soldiers in the theater of war there are getting hooked on heroin and then bringing it back, and there's a gigantic heroin epidemic that's only actually been surpassed by our current opioid crisis. We are now smack in the middle of the worst drug crisis in the history of the United States. People don't really realize that in terms of the death toll from this current, and that is a whole other story, which is involves our overseas wars. But this is the perffect storm of cynical big pharma. combined with our foreign adventures, it has combined to create this incredible drug problem that, interestingly, now a lot of people, though, are trying to treat it as a medical problem.
Right. Well, because
why?
Racial makeup of who's been affected
by white
it. People. Right, right, right.
All
right.
Of a sudden, oh, now, I mean, this opioid crisis is killing twice as many people as the crack epidemic. But you don't see anyone yelling about, you know, super predators or putting, you know, all these kids who are dying of heroin, you know, giving them life sentences.
Right. So there's a couple, and what it's just so funny though about the LSD one specifically is, and it, not to make light of it, because certainly dosing people ruined a lot of people's lives. There were suicides, and it was horrific. But it also, like, instead of creating like brainwashed soldiers or super assassins or an interrogation technique, it also helped create this like important counterculture. So, you know, there was a positive blowback in that case. But there's a couple of other notes to hit on this. And really, I can't stress enough, everybody should be watching this series. Go to, we don't have that much time, but I think that this actually provides a bigger context for understanding Freeway Rick Ross and the Contras. But before we get to the Contras, there was something that happened in the 70s called Operation Condor, which was basically the United States supporting Latin American far-right regimes and coordinating across borders to support death squads and military governments to essentially wipe out the left in Latin America. And when we say the left, it might have included some armed guerrilla groups, which if you have an understanding of Latin American history, it would make sense why you might form an armed guerrilla group. But also, you know, anybody that would be to
anybody.
The left
students,
of Bill Clinton.
Yeah,
students, trade unionists, anybody expressing any type of advocacy for even a social safety net or breaking up old power structures in Latin America. Not genocidal in the sense of ethnic, but mass killing of a political category supported directly by the CIA and the United States foreign policy. In Bolivia, there is a component of this story which is truly unbelievable, which is the culmination of Operation Condor, the drug war, and how it fits into the story, and also leads us to a character which helps us understand the Contras and Pablo Escobar, much more popular characters in the public imagination. But in Bolivia, what happened in the early 80s, truly unbelievable, sets the context for understanding all of it.
Yeah, I mean, this is another confluence of all these crazy strains of American post-Cold War policy, where not only were we in bed with all the fascist juntas in Argentina and for a brief, in Brazil and other countries, and we had a whole secret intel. We had basically a coordinate, in the same way we sort of have the Five Eyes, intelligence gathering, cooperation between us and our allies, right?
Right.
This was a similar program where we were sharing intelligence with the Argentine junta and all these guys to basically hunt down and kill, and even, their murders are happening on U.S. soil. But what was absolutely insane about this is part of this program also included some ex-Nazis. So there you had guys like Klaus Barbie, who was the butcher of Lyon, the Gestapo head of Lyon for Hitler, who fled, like many Nazis, to Bolivia, took on a new name. He was involved in the hunt, and basically he was an expert in surveillance of counterinsurgency warfare. So he actually helped the CIA and Felix Rodriguez and these guys hunt down Che Guevara and kill him. And then later, he basically had a mercenary group, and you can't make this up, called the Fiancés of Death. And they were full on neo-Nazis. They were just Nazis.
They were like original, literal Nazis.
Original. And younger guys. There were Germans that had come over. They even wore sort of pseudo swastika like armbands. These guys were full on a mercenary sort of like Nazi Blackwater, for lack of a better understanding, who were helping out different fascist regimes. So in 1979, coming into 1980, you had a series of coups in Bolivia. And at one point, and basically in 1980, there was sort of a weak left-leaning, pretty actually centrist government.
Right.
But there was all this turmoil. And basically, there's this other guy named Roberto Suarez. Roberto Suarez was the scion of the rubber fortune in Bolivia, who basically in the late 70s started to realize there was this huge growing demand for cocaine, started switching over all of his rubber plantations to coca, and he really was the coca king of South America. The Colombians at this point, Pablo Escobar and his partners, these guys were minuscule middlemen in the beginning. All the coke was coming out of Bolivia. That's why it's called Bolivian marching powder. It was all coming out of Bolivia and to somewhat some degree Peru. Roberto Suarez basically seizes opportunity because he's got all this money. He's got his own private army. He hires Klaus Barbie, and he basically has cover by the CIA. The CIA is not directly involved in this coup, but basically they launch a coup and take over the country and install their own leader with the help of Klaus Barbie, with the cover of the CIA, who basically, is the account we have, is the DEA agent in country who had infiltrated into Roberto Suarez's operation, was working on taking him down, was shut down by the CIA when he was getting too close because they saw the benefits of this puppet regime, and they just didn't care. The cocaine, no one cared. At that point, I mean, you could argue, in some ways, cocaine was really seen as like a party favor. It really was not seen as a dangerous drug. So it is, you could argue that, you know, the unforeseen consequences of that. But really, and then within two, so basically Roberto Suarez takes over Bolivia. It's known as the cocaine coup. And he starts flying military planes of tons of cocaine into Colombia, where the burgeoning middlemen there, led by the guys in Medellin, the Ochoa brothers and Pablo Escobar, they basically start figuring out how to bring cocaine on a massive scale. And really within a year or two, I mean, all this happens in such a quick amount of time. This goes in 1980, and by 1983, you have Rick Ross being supplied by Nicaraguan Contra suppliers, because the Boland Amendment in 1982 had cut off congressional funds for the Contras. And by 1983, Miami Vice is on the air, and cocaine is blowing up in Miami. I mean, it all happened so quick, and the whole skyline of Miami is built with cocaine money, and you have the birth of crack.
Right. And then Nancy Reagan's on TV. I mean, that's the other kind of thing that's great about the documentary, is you parallel the pop culture. So like in the 80s, we only have, unfortunately, a few minutes left, and there's a whole world to lay to waste. But it's just the way in the 1980s you have this synchronized, like, CIA in bed up to its elbows with, you know, cocaine money and its affiliates who are involved in the drug business. Then you have the wave of the racialized crackdowns, and we're seeing the resurgence of that, obviously, and you touch on Sessions and Trump and the return of, you know, even after these very modest Obama reforms, a full war on drugs, assault on communities of color. And then you have, you know, the Nancy Reagan and the kind of like lame drug ads, even at the same time, while, you know, everybody's doing it, and the gangsters are watching Miami Vice for fashion tips. The last thing I want you to touch on, because I think this is another story that people really need to get, and I almost feel like we could go on again, because you end with what's happening currently now in Mexico and Afghanistan, and it's the same dynamic. We're picking favorites. We have relationships with different cartels. Hamid Karzai's brother, as I say, was a major heroin trafficker, and the whole war in Afghanistan, people talk about, you know, Islam and on this and that, but a lot of it is about heroin.
It's a drug war. Yeah, it's a gigantic drug war at this point. The Taliban, their ideology is completely backseat. There is only one real cash crop in Afghanistan, and it's opium.
Right.
And that's what people are fighting over.
Right. So people will get that too. But there's something really particularly disgusting about the Bill Clinton story. Pushing through NAFTA, which as a side effect of NAFTA was obviously it made and you know, now we've went from Bolivia to Colombia, and now Mexico is the kind of epicenter of, you know, of Latin American cartels. NAFTA made it a lot easier for them. At the same time, Bill Clinton was implementing three strikes laws. No one was moving to the right of Bill Clinton on drug laws, throwing nonviolent offenders in prison, and militarization of the police when he first came into office. So he simultaneously is pushing through legislation, which will, as an indirect, you know, a side effect, will benefit the traffickers, and then again targeting the same communities that the Reagan administration targeted.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tragic story. It was another really one of these cases of a perfect storm, because you had at the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s, this major crackdown in Colombia where they, you know, they hunt down, if you everyone had seen Narcos,
right.
They hunt down and kill Pablo Escobar. And basically the Colombian, the guys who took over there, the Cali cartel, they realize, who had been in bed with the CIA, they realize that it's too hot to keep, continue being these vertical integrated operations that are controlling it, you know, from farm to table,
right.
That they need to get out of that business. And the Mexicans are rising. And there's a, we tell a story, I won't go into the details, but the, we basically tell you the whole story of how Mexico takes over. And right when that happens, that's right when NAFTA is passed. So you have this perfect storm. And the Clinton administration knew it and covered it up, that this was,
right.
that they're going to be empowering and really creating the conditions by which Mexico really devolves. And the tragedy of Mexico is really actually one of the saddest and most brutal stories. I mean, one of the Mexican journalists we interviewed for the series really broke down and cried at one point, because the just the incredible tragedy that Mexico is. I mean, they've lost more people than the Vietnam War over the last 10 years. So it's an incredible tragedy, and it's all fueled by our own demand and our own complicity in these major operations. As I think, you know, Celerino Castillo, an ex-DEA guy, says it best. He said to us, you know, America is too addicted to drug money, than they are to drugs. And it's never going to stop.
Right. Well, everybody needs to watch this. It's kind of amazing that it's on TV. You can put it all together, the whole frame from, you know.
I felt the same way when when I was watching last night. I just couldn't believe we actually got this on the air.
Yeah, and
on
I know.
Major, cable network.
Oh, it's awesome. And I know we've been talking about this kind of stuff for a long time, and it's great to see you, you know, get this project together. It's great.
Anthony, I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Thank you. Anthony LaPay,
thanks.
Showrunner, America's War on Drugs. It premiered last night. It's running tomorrow. Tonight's episode is
the cocaine episode that we've just been talking about at length. So I think it's really going to blow people's mind.
It really will. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
Take care. All right, everybody. We'll be right back with Nomiki Konst on the Majority Report. Back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Nomiki Konst. She's a correspondent for the Young Turks. How did that go?
That's good. That's good. We practiced it a few times.
We did. It's amazing.
Works. I mean,
yes.
Sometimes people get my first name and I'm really surprised, but then they'll say like Konst.
Konst.
Like, Konst. Oh, like, I've never had that problem my entire life, and now suddenly.
That's interesting. Well,
my constitution.
Well, we gotta practice. You know, you gotta walk before you can run, run before you can fly. which is my version of doing interviews. I'm like, if I can get the name pronunciation right, I'll nail it after that.
Nomi's fine also. You can go call me Nomi.
Did you feel that just massive sigh of relief?
Yeah. Now that that's done, let's get to the Democratic Party.
Whoa, now I'm stressed again. Nomi, you're on the Unity Reform Commission. What's going on? Mm-hmm. Tell us what the purpose of that is and where that process is at.
Yeah, I'm really, you know, grateful that you're welcoming conversation about this, because I think it's something that a lot of folks weren't aware of last year when all the chaos was going on around the convention. And of course, it took several months for the commission to get their nominations. Mm-hmm. So essentially, after... This is a little wonky, but people seem to be really into this right now, so I'm just going to go full force. Mm-hmm. After the convention last year, there was a rules committee around the time of the convention, and there was also a platform committee. Mm-hmm. Now, the platform committee is separate from the rules committee, and I want to make that really clear. So the platform committee came up with the issues that the Democrats stand for. It's the most progressive platform in history. I was a member of that. Mm-hmm. The rules committee discusses the rules, the process stuff around the Democratic Party, and it's what I believe caused a lot of the issues, the structural issues that we faced in the primaries, and mm-hmm. Just some of the other stuff, you know, why we lost 1,000 seats over, you know, the past decade. So the Rules Committee came up with a bunch of resolutions, and essentially they decided they were going to put forth a Unity Reform Commission to dig into the primary process, the presidential primaries, which includes, you know, caucuses, primaries, superdelegates, all the stuff that everybody wants to talk about, but also the reform of the party, which I think might actually be a little bit more important, because I think it affects, you know, how we select superdelegates. So, you know, DNC members, if you have a bunch of DNC members that are lobbyists, they're superdelegates. And mm-hmm. so they have vested interest in the outcome of, most likely, of the outcome of a certain presidential candidate. So if you go to that reform process and say, we don't want any more lobbyists in our Democratic Party, well, then that fixes some of the stuff that has to do with superdelegates. Of course, the Bernie camp wants to ban superdelegates, wants to reform the superdelegate process. So this all came out of the convention. And the commissions are not unique to the Democratic Party. We've had a series of commissions, some more effective than others. There was a commission in the early 80s that created superdelegates, and, you know, they looked a lot different than they evolved, you know, over the past 30 years, what they turned into. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a reform commission. So Bernie got to choose 7 people to join his commission to represent him, and, you know, Larry Cohen, who's the vice chair. And then Hillary got 9, and mm-hmm. Jen O'Malley Dillon, who's the chair of the commission, because Hillary won the primary. Mm-hmm. And then Tom Perez, of course, it was going to be whoever was the chair of the Democratic Party, got to choose 3. So we've had 2 meetings at this point. One was in D.C. over 2 days, and one was in San Antonio just a couple of weeks ago over 2 days as well. And our next meeting is the end of August after the summer break, and that's going to be in Chicago. And that's where we're going to get into, you know, probably working some of this stuff out. Because the first 2 were, we saw a lot of presentations. We learned quite a bit about the primary process, which is something I want to talk about with you, because I think there's a lot of misinformation and there was a lot of pushback over the past couple of weeks when I posted some stats on Twitter. And then people went after me saying I didn't understand what open primaries were. And I'm like, I actually think I know a little bit more, because we just had to sit through 2 days of presentations on all the different types of primaries.
I would just like to make clear that I do not. Just
well,
to be clear.
You being all humble.
Oh, no, I'm totally not humble. You must really not follow my work. No, I'm just honest. I have no idea. But no, what I want, get into the primary details, but... Mm-hmm. As maybe as a way to getting there, what I'm curious about, and this could be me being optimistic, but it seems to me that there are obviously there's sort of 2 different arguments inside the broad broadly speaking, the Democratic Party or progressive politics, whatever way you want to frame it, there's mm-hmm. a sort of insider-outsider thing. And mm-hmm. I think that, because as an example, you know, Tom Perez, to me, like, obviously I preferred Keith Ellison. I was a supporter of Keith Ellison. Mm-hmm. But you can see Tom Perez in some ways as like the establishment, if we want to use that word. Like, that's their kind of tip of the hat. Like, our yeah. answer is a liberal member of our team. So there's some recognition that, like, okay, maybe we need to be a bit more sort of robust in some type of progressive agenda. But at the same time, we don't want the outsiders coming in. We want the same consulting right. firms. We want the same,
yep.
you know, kind of top-down command structure. So there's insider yep. and outsider. And then there is, you know, at this point, there's real robust progressive liberal. And then there's, you know, kind of people who have been center or center right kind of moving to the kind of soft center left. So the debate has shifted, and that happened through the right. primary. It started with
right.
we're going to have a, you know, a centrist center right candidate as the nominee, and that's pretty much it. And then we had a real robust social democratic challenger, and then she had to kind of track a bit, and that's why you get a progressive platform. Although, you know, mm-hmm. the platform is a very most people don't know what the platform is, and if you don't campaign on the platform, you know, people are not going to digest it broadly. So I don't know if it was necessarily right. campaigned on. But and then we have all of this sort of, for lack of a better word, like Twitter melodrama. And I think that there's people on both, you know, sides of the equation. Like I thought the Bernie or bust thing was incredibly stupid and destructive, and I was mm-hmm. open about that. I think obviously, you know, there's people like Joy Reid who have, I don't even understand this kind of like, wow, this nice old Jewish guy who wants everybody to have healthcare. What an asshole. You know, like this bizarre, just utterly weird crusade against Bernie Sanders, which I, you know, I don't know what yeah. it says about people like Joan Walsh's kind of mental state. But or Joy right. Reid for that matter. But I think that what I'm saying is that and I'm going to get to the question in a second, but just setting the table, that Excellent. Debate has mostly kind of, to the extent there's been anything, has been this notion that there is a opposition between a serious inequality and universal programs agenda and a robust agenda on dealing with systemic racial gender oppression. Now, it right. seems to me in the real world, if you encounter somebody that supports universal Medicare for all, that's also going to be someone who wants serious reform of policing and the drug war and everything else and would love to vote for the first woman president. In the real world, I don't yep. think these things are oppositional outside of Twitter controversies. And I just am wondering, inside the conversation you're in, maybe the insider and outsider thing is still the strongest point of division, but there is some coalescing in a slightly more progressive agenda across the board from someone like you, who's a real, you know, for real Bernie person, to people who are Hillary people. That maybe the dividing line is still like who actually gets the consulting contracts and not mm-hmm. should we support a $15 minimum wage?
Yeah, I mean, the operative word in all of this yeah. was consulting contracts. Mm-hmm. In my opinion.
Okay.
I think, you know, now that Hillary's not running for office, and that doesn't mean that the infrastructure, a lot of the organizations around Hillary didn't exist, meaning sending out daily messaging and getting, you know, active Twitter users to people with large Twitter followings and just more aggressive Twitter battles to come out. Like, that stuff all comes from a higher place. Like, they get a signal. Mm-hmm. And we know that. We know that just, you know, there's strategists who can help us track that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I know that, like, on the Bernie side, sometimes we're kind of late to these battles. So if, like, Joy Reid goes after me, then suddenly, like, 100 Hillary bots come after me. And I'm not talking about, like, all... I'm talking about, like, really aggressive people.
Right.
And then, like, you know, 2 days later, it's, like, 5,000 Bernie people. It's more organic.
Right.
So, I mean, I think what's important to keep in mind here, and I have to apologize because
are you
I'm
like on
outside.
The run from Hillary people right now?
I'm literally on the run.
Okay.
No, I'm now sitting outside.
Okay.
I had to get out of my car. This is the life. This is 2016-17 life. What year is it? I don't know.
18.
So, you know, essentially, there are Hillary people who are very progressive. And
right.
who supported Hillary for a whole array of reasons.
Right.
There are Hillary people who are progressive and want serious reform in the party. And I think this is the really important thing to keep in mind when we're talking about the Unity Reform Commission. People realize we lost 1,000 seats and we lost against a Cheeto, right?
Right.
And that's like a major shock to so many different Democrats, like psyches. Like they had this idea of what the Democratic Party was and what they were able to accomplish. And they went to all these events and it looked, you know, we looked like we were winning the message. And you look at, you know, when you look at like Pew reports, you realize the country's becoming more progressive, but we're losing everywhere. And I think a lot of folks, and I remember this during the primary, were just conflicted. It wasn't hitting them yet. And now I think people are feeling it and they're ready to reform because they just want to win things back. Now, that's not everybody, and it's definitely not everybody on Twitter. And the question is, like, how do we do it? I think within the commission, there's a lot of real hearty debate about how we do it. There are folks on the commission who've been Democrats and have seen these battles over years, like Charlie Baker, who's on the commission. You know, he was on Dukakis's campaign. Elaine Carmack, who was, you know, she was there for the battle between Carter and Kennedy. So we've had these kinds of debates before, just not at this level.
Mm-hmm.
And my concern is that we become obsessed with this group is not getting resources and this group is not getting resources and we're all fighting for scraps. But at the end of the day, I'd say every single person, except maybe a couple that have are invested in this business model, pretty much everybody on the commission realizes we spent almost all of our money on major media buys and consultants. And as a result, you have the ethnic community and the millennials and the LGBTQ community and African Americans all pitted up against each other, fighting for the scraps, the resources. Because that's what this is about. It's resources. Not to mention that states aren't getting funding. So there's communication coming out of many different groups. You know, there's organizations like the CDC that are pushing. You know, they don't want super delegates to go away, or they don't want, you know, they don't want open primaries because I think they're looking at some flawed data. Like there's been updated data on this. You know, 12 million people, possibly more if you include caucuses, weren't able to vote because there are every state has their own set of primary rules. It's not like, you know, every open primary is the same, and it's not like every closed primary is the same. And there are so many different primaries in between. Like Colorado has like a semi-open primary and same day registration. So, you know, there's just so much data now that we can build from and be really smart about this rather than saying, you know, African Americans are going to lose their vote if we have open primaries, or Republicans are going to vote a primary if we have open primaries. Well, not their same day registration. The numbers just go down. And there are absolutely, I recognize there are some cases like in Mississippi years ago where people were doing that. Very small numbers. And I think we're in a different world today. And I think if you start to look at the 12 million people plus that weren't able to vote, especially millennials, the most diverse generation in history, 50% of millennials are independent. And it's the most diverse generation in history. Now, there's some people who are like, well, you should just become a Democrat. Well, it's like, never blame the voter. We should not start from a place of let's blame the voter. We should start from a place of what are we doing as a party that is not connecting with these people? And if that means that we're not welcoming them and we're not operating in every single district in our country and we're not investing our message in races all over the country and we're just investing in seats like Ossoff's seat that we think we have a chance, but we're ignoring, you know, 20 other elections, that means our message is not out there connecting with folks.
We
and
don't
that's
have
when you have Trump.
Right.
Yeah. And
it's not a national message. And it's also not, you know, and I think this is really, really important because I think there's another conversation that gets so skewed. Like, it isn't a white working class problem. It's a working class problem.
Yeah.
And it's a rising electorate problem across the board. And if you want to look at the future of progressive politics, I mean, young people fuel Jeremy Corbyn as an example. And young people, as you say, I mean, look, race and those divisions are never going to go away. They're at like the heart of this country. But when you're talking about younger voters, those issues are very synchronized, the class, and they are in general. But I guess this is my last question for you. I think the other side of this that gets lost, and I hope everybody's getting really serious about, is even as we're debating like the merits of open primaries and will people come in and dilute the process or whatever, that's abstract. What we do know is that the other reason that Hillary got hurt that wasn't the Clinton campaign's fault, that wasn't part of their mistakes, was that there is a nationwide effort by Republican legislatures to suppress Black and Hispanic voters. So it's like, if we're talking on that level, the civil rights agenda, the programmatic agenda, and the Democrats' win agenda is from North Carolina to Wisconsin, there is a conscious effort to make it harder for people to vote. And that has had a major effect. So I want to know, as a final question, where the state of that is, because it seems to me that voting rights is defining for both, like, simply civil rights being viable in this country and, you know, operationally for, like, are you going to win Wisconsin? Well, it ain't all your messaging if they're suppressing the Black vote, which they are.
Yeah, and I think we're not necessarily dealing with general election issues on the Unity Reform Commission, but I do think that there are things that we can do to make voting easier in the primary process that sets the stage for a fight at the general election level. Meaning, if your state is invested in getting people to the polls during the primary process, and what we have to keep in mind here is, you know, yes, this is the DNC, and a lot of people are like, well, the DNC doesn't have oversight when it comes to how primaries are run. State parties and legislatures are the ones who set those things. But we can send a very strong message, and there is some, like, legal precedent to do so, by the way.
Right.
But if we invest those resources, if we say we're willing to take that seriously, and we are, especially in a state like New York, where 117,000 ballots were lost and purged in Brooklyn, and it's the most closed primary system in the country, in a state that has elected a Democratic governor, a Democratic legislature, and a Senate, which, you know, that's a whole other story because eight of them have decided to go caucus Republicans, handing the Senate to the Republicans. But New York State should be overwhelmingly progressive, and yet they have the most closed primary in the country. And what that means is that, you know, you're not, when you're not investing early in voting, in the process, you're saving it all to the general election, and that's putting the burden on, it's frankly putting the burden on the DNC. You know, but this all comes back to resources, right? So states complain that they're not getting, and they rightfully complain, that they're not getting the money at the state parties to work on recruiting candidates, training candidates, setting up operations in different districts, you know, building a real cohesive party at the state level. And that is all based on, I think, flawed polling of what messages work. I mean, you look at Christine Pellegrino in Long Island, who flipped a Trump district 40 points. It's because she talks about working class issues. Right. But that's not something the Democratic Party has been doing. So, you know, it's all based on a different business model and a different mentality of what it means to be a progressive. Now, if the party stops spending all of its money on these major media consultants, because let's be clear here, there was $1 billion spent over the past 2 years. The majority of it went to major media buys and polling and folks like GMMB who, yeah, do important work, but do they need to suck up 95% of the Democratic Party's budget and leave nothing for the states? No.
Well, not when we launch our consulting firm. Nomi, I really appreciate your time. Nomi Kantz,
thank you.
Correspondent for the Young Turks. I'll get your name 100% next time.
You did great. Okay. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate your time. Right. Thanks so much. We're going to go to the fun half, everybody, because we are running a little late today. You know all the ways you can support the show, so please do it. 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. So much to get to in the fun half, including a meltdown by the dumbest man on YouTube, the soft alt-right ringleader himself, Dave Rubin. Oh, wait. Hope I'm not being libelous there. Excuse me. We'll see you in the fun half.
celebration sang. She said, no, 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 things are looking bad. She said, no, 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 and if it was a